Now, Maxwell's a different story. The New York Times has never done a big blowout on Maxwell. All the fucking victims, alleged victims, that were not part of the indictment. If the New York Times was interested in these things, they could do it very easily. They have the resources. They're not interested in it. In fact, they help cover up sexual assaults, Harvey Weinstein, etc., for years. Okay. Put a lid on that for years while other women were raped by Weinstein. The New York Times had it 15 years earlier, and they put a lid on it. That's where the New York Times head is at. And they're interested in telling you that new documents reveal that Jeffrey Epstein was smirking and he was not suicidal in the days before his death. It makes you wonder where these new documents came from, how long the New York Times has had these new documents, because they sat on Harvey Weinstein's raping women in Hollywood for 15 years. And by doing so, again, dozens, potentially hundreds of other women were raped and molested, etc. But don't worry, the Times has come out with a fantastic story saying that suicide was against Epstein's Jewish religion and that he was smirking. The Times report is painting Epstein as a master of manipulation. Really, do you think so? Yeah. You know what this smells like to me? Somebody who was in journalism for a while, worked in the New York market. This is the Justice Department saying, you know what, put out a story that says that Epstein wasn't really suicidal in the days before his death. But in the story, make sure that you basically conclude that he killed himself so you can put that to rest. Maybe also serve as a little bit of a distraction from what's going on with the Maxwell trial. Instead, the New York Times should be fucking knee-deep in the Maxwell trial. They have no interest, none. They're in the tank for the rich and famous. They're owned by the rich and famous. They have money coming in from Mexico. Cartel-backed money running and helping support the New York Times. Look it up, Carlos Slim. Look it up. Look at his connections to fucking drug cartels. You can't even make it up. Why would anybody think that these guys are going to do anything but play their role in the protection racket? Plain and simple. Take care. God bless.
The metaverse is expanding. The metaverse is expanding. We talked to you already about that metaverse, but now the metaverse has got so bloody big that even God self is in it. Has Mark Zuckerberg gone from playing God to being God's landlord? And should we be worried about that? I mean, who's going to clear up? Who's going to pay the rent? What if the pipes burst? Zuckerberg? Hello there, you 4.5 million miracles, you marvels, you wonders, you awakening sources of light in my life. Hey, I'm on tour. Come and see me if you're in the UK. There's a link in the description. Between January and May, I'll be available to you. But you could also just sit home in a metaverse and look at me in there. I'll probably be in there. I won't have no choice about it. God's in there. You've got to get in there. Everyone's in there. Let's see what's going on in this bloody metaverse. Facebook, which recently passed $1 trillion in market capitalization, may seem like an unusual partner for a church whose primary goal is to share the message of Jesus. Not in a way, because if you think there was a sort of obviously a period in the history of the church which was clearly about expansionism, imperialism, and power. But the company has been cultivating partnerships with a wide range of faith communities over the past few years, from individual congregations to large denominations like the Assemblies of God and the Church of God in Christ. So I suppose what Facebook know is that one of the communities that will continue to use Facebook as younger users migrate to other platforms are older traditional churchy folk. Now, after the coronavirus pandemic pushed religious groups to explore new ways to operate, Facebook sees even greater strategic opportunity to draw highly engaged users users onto its platform. The company aims to become the virtual home for religious community and wants churches, mosques, synagogues and others to embed their religious life into its platform, from hosting worship services and socializing more casually to soliciting money. It's developing new products, including audio and prayer sharing, aimed at faith groups. In a way, let's face it, I'm not a mad Luddite. Are you? I like technology. It's fantastic stuff. What I get concerned about is when it seems to replace ideology rather than support ideology. It's just a utensil. It's just a tool. It's just a way of communicating. How fantastic, how positive, how miraculous that you and I can connect even in this way right now. But in places of congregation and unity and togetherness, where you seek to explore the deeper mysteries of life that are not ascertainable through the senses, the deep connection through consciousness to a force that is difficult to understand, accessible to all of us and excluding none of us, you don't really want that to be brokered by an organisation that might have monetary gain at the forefront of its collective mind. These partnerships reveal how big tech and religion are converging far beyond simply moving services to the internet. Facebook is shaping the future of religious experience itself, as it has done for political and social life. What's, I suppose, fascinating about Facebook, or Meta, as I suppose we must now call it, is the giddying vastness of its vision. The expansionism's almost without precedent. Companies like Carnegie and all these great sort of figures of a century ago that were making money out of human energy had a certain kind of power, but within certain limitations, because they were dealing with material, plundering the earth for its mineral resources. A company like Facebook is plundering consciousness itself for the resources of consciousness, of attention. Attention itself is being corralled and managed. And now it's become explicitly ideological. All things can exist there. Perhaps you could argue there's no difference between a religious community using Facebook and like a bunch of people selling level wallets somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, but for me, it feels like it's a deepening and an expansion and a kind of indication of the ambition of this project. I just want people to know that Facebook is a place where, when they feel discouraged or depressed or isolated, they could go and immediately connect with a group of people that care about them, said Nona Jones, the company's director for global faith partnerships and a non-denominational minister. And I suppose that's a good thing, that all of us could use online spaces to create connections. And in fact, activism and protest and sharing and kindness and love and all these things are, of course, possible through technology. Technology does not have a morality. It is beyond morality. It's a tool that will bear the inflection of the users and the most powerful operators within it. In my conversation with Vandana Shiva last week on my podcast, Under the Skin, she talked about how even apparently objective algorithms are necessarily, and obviously on reflection, constructed, engineered. So while they sort of seem to present you with a kind of objectivity, algorithm says this, algorithm says that, it's a result of human input, of course. So these are not objective or neutral tools, they are the equipment of the powerful. Facebook executives pitched their efforts to religious groups at a virtual faith summit. Sheryl Sandberg, the company's chief operating officer, shared an online resource hub with tools to build congregations on the platform. Faith organizations and social media are a natural fit because fundamentally both are about connection. Let me tell you some other things we can compare. Both can be about replacing the internal spontaneous experience with a set of doctrines and dogma that prevent you having immediate agency. Mr. Sandberg said, our hope is one day people will host religious services in virtual reality spaces as well, or use augmented reality as an educational tool to teach their children the story of their faith. Nothing wrong with that. If, like, you have other priorities about connection and understanding of nature, inner and outer, but we can see the way this is progressing. There is a lack of balance. This is being undertaken in the name of a corporate project, and we can't pretend it's neutral or a wait and see situation. It's a form of colonization of consciousness itself. But I'm biased. You can't trust me. Let's see what Mark Zuckerberg's got to say about the metaverse and how it might influence the church.
Starting with the most important experience of all, connecting with people.
I don't know what's happening in Mark Zuckerberg's mind when I look at his face, do you? Because it's a lot sort of happening. There's a lot of, like, inner life in there, but I don't know what it relate to? I mean, obviously, it's someone who has the capacity to create a sort of an unparalleled infrastructure, but it also makes me feel not like, this is good, this is happening.
Your avatar will be able to make natural eye contact and reflect your facial expressions in real time.
Terrifying.
This way, people you're interacting with will have a real sense of how you're actually feeling.
What? Like if you met them?
I know this is a big deal for a lot of people. Not everyone wants their social media profile linked to all these other experiences, and I get that, especially as the metaverse expands. And I'll share more about that later.
I get that. I'll deal with that later, after I've got a few more billions.
I think this could be very positive for our society.
The collaborations raise not only practical questions, but also philosophical and moral ones. Religion has long been a fundamental way humans have formed community, and now social media companies are stepping into that role. Facebook has nearly 3 billion active monthly users, making it larger than Christianity worldwide, which has 2.3 billion adherents, or Islam, which has 1.8 billion users. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because when it comes to it, they're just ways which you might spend your time. You might be on Facebook, you might be in prayer. You might be on Facebook, you might be down a soup kitchen feeding people. You might be on Facebook, you could be with a family member having some kind of experience, could be walking in nature. It's this colonization that I suppose concerns most of us that are skeptical about the ongoing march of these powerful organizations. There are privacy worries too, as people share some of the most intimate life details with their spiritual communities. The potential for Facebook to gather valuable user information creates enormous concerns, said Sarah Lane Ritchie, a lecturer in theology and science at the University of Edinburgh. The goals of businesses and worshipping communities are different, she said. Yeah, of course. In fact, the whole point of religion and spirituality is to free you from having your consciousness tethered to the goals of economic and materialistic systems, is to awaken an aspect of your nature that is dormant and underserved by a rationalist and materialistic culture. If that too becomes co-opted by yet another economic space, that's another potential avenue of escape foreclosed, which I suppose, as part of the broader picture, is why it's happening. And many congregations, often with older members, may not understand how they could be targeted with advertising or other messages based on their religious engagement. Sometimes I think this is all fancy and ideological, but of course, really all that will happen is there'll be lots of adverts for hearing aids and sort of wheelchairs and then mobility scooters and stuff that they assume that particular audience requires, because it's not on market, as they'll call it, because it's not really about anything other than how do you generate revenue. That's what the algorithm does. If the algorithm was changed to how do you generate happiness, you'd get all sorts of different results, and you wouldn't be able to have a shareholder corporate model. You'd have to have a different type of model, which actually is possible. Corporations are not worried about moral code, she said. I don't think we know yet all the ways in which this marriage between big tech and the church will play out. This is an ongoing theme. We are dealing with technology that we don't understand, that we're not evolved to understand, and we can't see the outcomes because they are beyond our kind of ability to predict or project or game out. Even though these technologies are a result of human input, they have their own teleology that's difficult for us to predict. A Facebook spokeswoman said the data it collected from religious communities would be handled the same way as other users. Phew! Many of Facebook's partnerships involve asking religious organisations to test or brainstorm new products. Those sweet religious ceremonies that even the more commonplace one of passing around a church plate will soon be replaced by hollering, hawking salesmen offering you Stanislaus and incontinence pads. Are you worried about dying? Yes, I am. This is a nice coffin, though. Because it's the corporatization of something that's sort of rather antiquated, arcane and sweet. You don't imagine the sort of sinister fugue of Facebook's power seeping into village halls, church basements and places of the sacred with the same intent. How do we extract revenue from these people? The pandemic accelerated existing dynamics, packed years of technology development into one, said Bob Pritchett, who founded FaithLife, a Christian ministry platform with a suite of online services. But spiritual life is different from the personal and professional spaces occupied by Facebook and LinkedIn, he said. It's dangerous to have your community anchored on a tech platform that is susceptible to all the whims of politics and culture and congressional hearings, he said. Facebook created its Faith Partnerships team in 2017 and began courting religious leaders, especially of evangelical and Pentecostal groups, in earnest in 2018. Facebook basically said, hey, we want to be the it. We want it to be the go-to, said the Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, a Sacramento pastor who leads a large coalition of Hispanic churches. We already have the sort of horrific archetype of the evangelical preacher corruptly robbing his flock in order to feather his own nest. And now we're turbocharging that with technology. For some pastors, Facebook's work raises questions about the broader future of church in a virtual world. So much of religious life remains physical, such as sacraments or the laying on of hands for healing prayer. For churches like Hillsong Atlanta, the ultimate goal is evangelism. We've never been more postured for the Great Commission than now, Pastor Sam Collier said, referring to Jesus's call to make disciples of all nations. He is partnering with Facebook, he said, to directly impact and help churches navigate and reach the consumer better. Consumer isn't the right word, he said, correcting himself. Reach the parishioner is better. No, I think you had it right the first time. To merge the church with Facebook is like to merge a shark with a potato. There's no way that the church will be able to stand up to the audacious power of this rapacious predator. But that's just what I think. Tell me what you think. Let me know in the comments below. And if you enjoyed this video, have a look at this cheeky little guy. And if you want to enrich your own spiritual life now, get on Facebook. No, have a look at this little video on my side channel. Teach yourself a little bit of meditation. Please sign up to my mailing list so we can stay in touch with each other. Come and see me live if you've got the time. If you're in the UK between January and May, and please stay free.
Another, everybody have the blues. Can you dig it?
Yeah.
Now you take the little baby that's laying in the cradle, kicking and hollering and going on and tearing up the little baby bed, can't get that milk bottle fast enough, it's got the blues. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Now you take this girl, got this main squeeze. That's a boyfriend, you know. And he just bought a brand new GTO. You know she wanna be with him every time he cranks it up. If he ain't going nowhere but around the corner to the soda fountain, she wanna be right with him and show it off. This is why all the guys and gals be, you know. And this particular night, she get ready to go out. The mother said, whoa, wait a minute. You can't make it tonight, daughter. You were just out last night. That too many nights in a row. And she'll go in the room and fasten the door. And won't eat, won't talk to nobody. What's wrong with her? I can't hear you. What's wrong with her? She sure enough got the blues. Some people call them the reds, the pinks, but when you get through, it's the old-fashioned country blues, that's all it is. I ain't seen my main squeeze in 10 long weeks today. You know I got them.
Thank you very much. Woo! I think we might be going on.
The QAnon movement really is a movement that spun out of your digital soldiers. I'm tired of these QAnon people attacking me.
Maybe, I don't know that.
But you know some of them.
I think it's a disinformation campaign. I think it's a disinformation campaign that the CIA created. That's what I believe. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but that's what I think it is. I think it's a disinformation campaign. It's actually a very, very interesting article today out that was sent to me. I'll send it to you about how the QAnon movement has failed and all that. But I find it total nonsense, and I think it's a disinformation campaign created by the left, and the types of people that can create something like that are the kinds of people that we train for certain with certain skills in the CIA.
I'm aware that the CIA does it.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's what it was.
Yeah, I'm aware the CIA does programs where they'll give you 75% of the truth and then wrap it in a package that makes you look crazy to demean the truth
right.
They gave you. And I've always assumed that Q, as it originally started, may have been a white hat operation that got, in effect, kidnapped by the black hats, or is either a black hat or a white hat. I don't know. I don't care. What Q stood for initially, I've always believed, one, there were Q drops. I never really understood them, didn't look at them. But I understood what Q stood for.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I feel like I'm trying to do here for myself in terms of my faith, I believe the only issue that's before this country right now that's of primary importance is to investigate the communist effort to steal our presidency.